Welcome to the 54th episode of It Wasn't Me, a true crime podcast where we discuss murders that intrigue us. I am Mercedes.
And I am Cindy. Thank you for listening to last week's episode where I told you about the horrifying details of a young boy murdered by his own father, who, by the way, became the real reason parents everywhere check their children's Halloween candy.
Our show is often horrifying and graphic, and we will use offensive language. So if you have kids, put them away for a while and join us for a murder. Also, we are passionate and always have been about true crime, but we must warn you that sometimes we'll make jokes and laugh during our podcast.
Want to learn more about us? Visit our website at itwasn'tmetruecrime.com to find links to our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages. If you like what you hear and you'd like to help us out, please subscribe to our podcast on our favorite on your favorite platform and leave us a 5-star rating along with a comment. Also, please recommend our podcast to your friends. The more the merrier.
Hey, Cindy, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I had a nice Veterans Day off, and just want to say happy Veterans Day to all of our veterans out there. Give a shout out to, Will, my favorite veteran. So how was your week?
It was okay. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Life seems to be getting back on track.
Well, that's good. I'm glad. I've been, crazy weather we're having lately. Just kind of on edge about that. But other than that, everything's great.
Yeah. I was kind of hoping if it was going to come this way, it would have done it today. So maybe we could have 3 days off in a row, a weekend.
Yeah, that would be nice, wasn't it? We still have hopes for Friday, right?
Right.
Okay, so tell me, are you ready just to jump right in? All right, Cindy. So tell me, what do you know about the Craigslist killer?
Very little. I mean, a young guy, didn't he lure someone, obviously using Craigslist, or a couple of people, right?
Yes. So most likely you would probably be thinking of the guy from Boston.
Yes.
Who was a medical student, or he was a medical residency. I can't remember. I'm not talking about Philip Markoff. That's who he is.
Yes.
He was an engaged MD student who lured sex workers. And he ended up murdering a masseuse all through Craigslist. And he basically did that to rob them.
Okay.
But that's not the guy I'm doing. I'm doing the very first guy who was called the Craigslist killer.
Oh, I didn't know there was more than one.
I didn't either. So I'm kind of, kind of surprised by this. So the first one was from Savage, Minnesota, which is a small suburban city about 18 miles outside of Minneapolis.
Okay.
Now, he's not really the focus of this week's episode, even though he is, because really the victim, like, she was larger than life. And I kind of tripped on him because, you know, her family and friends, like, still, like, she's a huge presence in their lives still. So, you know, that's probably why we don't hear of him.
Okay.
All right. So I have another question. Are you ready?
Sure.
All right. Let's just say that you're outside. You're at an outdoor recreational area, like a huge state park or something.
Okay.
And you go to the trash can and you just look in the trash can, you're putting your trash in there, and you just see a purse sitting there.
It
isn't pushed down or covered up or anything. It's just laying on top of the closed garbage bag, perfectly clean. What are you going to do?
Probably open it up and like look to see if there's like identification or something like that to give it to someone.
Okay. Exactly.
Yes.
And I'm starting the story at this point. This is where I'm starting the story, just because I was just shocked. Now, I always hear things about Minnesotans. Is that how you say that? Minnesotans. And how they're very nice and they're kind and they're, you know, morally upright people. You're looking at me like crazy, but yeah.
No, it just sounded like someone fell down in the room.
Oh, are they okay? Or are they wrestling?
There was no sound. I mean, other than the falling.
Okay.
I'm sure it was Isaac.
Okay. Well, on October 26, 2007, the Savage Police Department got a phone call from someone reporting a purse in a trash can at Warren Butler Park, which
That's
is
my
a 20.
Sorry.
Go ahead. What? All right. Well, Warren Butler Park is just a huge 26-acre park, typical, lots of ball fields, tennis courts, horseshoe pits, you know, where you would go to hang out with your dog or, you know, take the kids, have a birthday party, whatever.
Right.
Anyway, an officer ended up responding to this and they found the purse along with a smashed cell phone. Both of them had been laying on top of a black garbage bag that had been tied up and put into the park trash can, but it was obviously not the same kind of trash bag as the park used.
Oh, okay.
The officer
maybe
found
someone disposed of their stuff there.
Right. Like they just put trash and it looked like a household trash bag. So it was kind of odd for it to be there.
Okay. I mean, okay. I mean, so maybe someone brought their own trash bag with them to put their trash in.
And that could be it. Right. And I'm not sure why this stood out. The whole thing stands out to me because, you know, somebody made the call. Anyway, the officer did look into the purse and found that it belonged to 24-year-old Catherine Olson, according to the driver's license. Money and everything was still in there. All of her ID, everything was still in the purse from what they knew. So, of course, the officer calls dispatch and says, you know, can you go check this address? Further investigation, I found this purse. At that point, he also opened the black garbage bag and he found what appeared to be bloody towels.
Bloody?
Bloody.
Oh.
And later, when they took this to the forensic, the medical examiner, they found that one of the towels had Anderson, the name Anderson, written in it with a black Sharpie. You know, like, I don't know. Did you used to write names, your kids' names on towels and sheets and stuff when they took them to places? Because I did.
Maybe not sheets, but I've labeled our stuff before. Yeah.
All right. So police went to Olson's residence that was on her driver's license, but she wasn't home. And they spoke with her roommate, a guy named Matt. I'm not going to say his last name. And he told them that Olson had never come home the day before, which was sort of weird, but you know, who is he to judge? She's 24, has her own life. But he did say that he had last seen her the day before, just as she was leaving for Savage for a babysitting job. So she lived about 18 miles from where this babysitting job was. Okay. And he told police that Catherine had told him that something was really strange about the woman who had arranged to interview her for the babysitting job, but she went anyway. Okay. None of her friends or family had heard from Catherine, which was extremely odd because she kept in continuous contact through texts and social media. She was an extrovert. She loved to talk. So it was not like her to go completely silent. Her parents did tell the police that sometimes she would go weeks without communicating with them, which is not abnormal. Do you think for a 24-year-old, just go time without communicating with her parent?
And they're in the same town or a different town?
They're in the same town, I think, or pretty close.
I mean, it just depends.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I would say that I went weeks without talking to my parents, but we didn't have the best relationship.
Yeah. I mean, Libby doesn't go weeks without talking to me.
Okay. And did you talk to your parents every day at that age? You did, didn't you?
Not every day. Yeah. I don't talk to my parents every day now.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mom.
Love you. Anyway, no one had heard from Catherine, and police have her purse and a bag of bloody towels. So, of course, that is a reason for people to be concerned.
Yes. Yeah. I agree.
So they expanded the search for Catherine, and within a few hours of finding her purse, they found her gold 2003 Hyundai Elantra, which is only 5 miles from where they found her purse, her crushed phone, and the bag with the bloody towels.
Okay.
The inside of her car seemed undisturbed, but when the police opened the trunk, they did find a fully clothed deceased female crammed into a bloody sleeping bag.
Oh, no.
And the body was quickly identified as Catherine Olson. She had been shot in the back.
That's awful.
Yeah. So the investigation, of course, went into full swing. Savage Police Captain David Mulkin and Chief Rodney Sewer notified Catherine's parents, Rolf and Nancy Olson, about her death. Now, Rolf Olson was a reverend at, I can't remember the church. I think it might have been a Lutheran church or something.
Mm-hmm.
But when the two officers arrived, one of them was in tears trying to explain to them what happened. The Olsons described their daughter as having been full of life and laughter. And when police were asking questions, they told police that their daughter was extroverted, talkative, had many friends, that she was well-loved. She was kind and compassionate. She was often described as the girl who loved sunshine, which, by the way, is etched on her gravestone. Basically, she had no enemies. No one disliked her. As a matter of fact, people just loved her dearly. Police Mulkin and another detective, Laura Kvasnicka, were the lead. She was a lead detective sergeant for the case. Both attended the funeral. So, you know, like, they had planned to sit quietly out of sight just to observe everyone. But the parents, Rolf and Nancy, insisted that they sit up front with the family. And to this day, the Olsons and the police detectives speak highly of each other. Nice. And also, you know, how they handled this, how the law enforcement handled the case. So there's no bad
blood.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then, of course, law enforcement said that this family always stood out to them for their kindness and compassion, even at their darkest moment. So investigators learned a lot about Catherine from her family and friends. They learned that she was pretty, curly-haired with freckles, described as exuberant. The 24-year-old had huge dreams of being an actress. I mean, she was a thespian. She graduated with honors from high school and college, which, by the way, she went to St. Olaf, which I never knew was a real college. I just know it from the Golden Girls, St. Olaf. Yes. Right? Yeah. So, yeah, that's actually a real college for those of you who did not know. St. Olaf was a school that Catherine went to, as did her sister and her mom, and I think maybe her dad did. She was fluent in Spanish. She did travel a lot. She was taking night classes because originally she wanted to become an interpreter, but she was somewhat at a crossroads about her career path when this incident occurred. She had recently told her mom that interpreting was not the career for her. And another friend said that Catherine needed to talk and express herself. And so she knew that if she became an interpreter, she would not be able to express herself, because an interpreter only expresses, you know, the person they're interpreting, right? So,
oh yeah, but sometimes they're very animated. Yeah.
And that maybe that's because the people they're interpreting for are animated. I don't know. She decided that wasn't for her personality. She told her dad, "I don't want to be invisible. I don't want to be behind the scenes. I'm an actress." And her mom agreed that Catherine was too energetic and dramatic. She just danced into people's lives. So at this point, she still planned to attend grad school in Madrid, but she was planning on changing her major to acting.
Okay.
She also knew that she had to save up some money. So, and she had worked a wide assortment of jobs. She had waited tables, of course, taught Spanish. She did interpret some. She had recently helped coach a high school speech team. And in the past, she also nannied, which she really liked. Her coaching job, I said, had just ended, so she needed a new gig. And in the past, she'd found those two decent nanny jobs through Craigslist, and one of them even allowed her to go to Turkey. So it was natural for her to turn to Craigslist again in October 2007.
Is Craigslist even a thing anymore?
I think so. I don't know. I don't ever use it, but
I don't either, because of crap like this.
Right. But, you know, any kind of marketplace or anything like this has to be careful of. But anyway,
I know sometimes I wonder, like now during this time, like I'm, you know, selling clothes or whatever, like on Facebook Marketplace. And I am like wondering, because I'm doing like the porch pickup only.
Right.
So I'm like, oh, you know, are they going to like come back?
I don't ever want anyone to know where I live. So I always meet at, you know, like a big parking lot where there are a lot of people.
I don't want to talk to them.
Yeah.
I don't want to meet them. I want them to come get the stuff and like Venmo. Yeah. Like, I'm not taking cash, Venmo, PayPal, whatever. Right. Well, I don't have that. Well, then I'm sorry. Go somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she and her parents said she was not fearful of it at all. I mean, she was just naturally, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about her personality, but she kind of attracted the underdog to her because she was super friendly and to anyone. Like she, if she saw somebody was sitting by themselves, she would, you know, totally embrace them and bring them into the fold and have them hang out with the group. So, you know, she wasn't afraid of meeting new people through Craigslist at all. She was super happy when she found a promising nanny listing that was only 18 miles away from where she lived. So she definitely applied for that immediately. Police learned from friends and family that she got an immediate response to the ad, and she was emailing back and forth with a woman named Amy, and they exchanged their information via email. Catherine had told her dad that she was being interviewed by a married couple who had recently relocated to the Twin Cities, and somehow the interview had turned into an agreement that Catherine would actually babysit the 5-year-old that day. So at first it was just an initial interview with the husband and the wife. And then it was, oh my gosh, I need a babysitter from 10:30 to 5. And then it changed to 9 to 3 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that was on Thursday, October 20th.
Okay.
So she agreed. She told her roommate that the woman seemed a little strange because she's like, you know what, who would want someone to babysit their kid that they haven't met or even seen if it was a good fit? So she just thought it was really weird. Anyway, she told him she would be home later, and she turned and walked out the door, never to return. When asked if it would be odd for Catherine not to come home or not to be in contact, police learned that she had so much energy that she was lovingly described as being a lot of work. So she had a thought or an idea. She actually called somebody or she posted it. You know, she was, I guess she processed everything by talking it out. So people were very surprised when she never called them about the job because it was not like her. They're like, she should be calling any minute. Tell us all about it. They knew that she'd made an appointment to interview for the job on Thursday. And by Friday, her sister was like, you know, there's something wrong. I'm going to call her roommate. So she called Matt, and Matt told her that Catherine had gone to the babysitting job the day before, but never came home. So, of course, they were all worried. And this was because this was so unlike Catherine. And the next contact that the family had was when the police called saying that they found her purse. So investigators continued sifting through evidence and asking questions. And they actually had quite a bit of evidence to sift through. They, of course, had the bloody towels, one of which had the name Anderson written in black Sharpie. So, right. I mean, that's a name right there. Then they found a partial print on the garbage bag, like where it's tied. And they had some red twine because red twine had been used to bind Catherine's feet together. Okay. Most importantly,
it was in the garbage can also.
It was on her body. It was tied around her legs.
Okay.
Her feet or her ankles. So they also had access to her email account, which was kind of like the mother load of evidence because it showed an exchange of emails between Catherine and this woman named Amy. And Catherine had responded to an email request for a babysitter from Amy who lived in Savage. And in the emails to Olson, Amy indicated that she needed someone to watch her daughter on October 25th, as I said before. The email included Amy's home address. So not only do they have the name Anderson on a towel, but now they have a home address where this babysitting job is.
Okay.
And they also had a phone number because Catherine's cell phone records show that she made an 85-second call on October 25th at 8:57 to a cell phone number. And when they tracked that, they found that it was owned by one Michael Anderson. The address also belonged to a family named Anderson.
Okay.
So the address and phone number matched Anderson's address and cell phone number, as well as the last name written on that bloody towel. And this was definitely enough evidence for search warrants, for DNA evidence, and to search the residence. So not long after, investigators from the Missouri Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the BCA, examined Olson's body. They found Anderson's DNA and other evidence collected from the Anderson residence. So they also seized computers from the Anderson home, and they showed that someone in the home had posted numerous Craigslist ads, including the one that Catherine had responded to.
So these people didn't cover their tracks very well.
No, definitely not a smart criminal here. Police also requested from Craigslist, you know, a dossier on Anderson's use of the website, which I'll tell you more about in the trial, but they did. They sent a 127-page dossier on his Craigslist activities. That's pretty significant, 127 pages, right?
Yeah.
And her autopsy revealed that she died from a gunshot wound to her back. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this during the appeal because, I'll just tell you now. I'll probably end up repeating myself. But according to the ME, she had injuries to her knees, nose, and forehead, which made it reasonable to conclude that when she was shot in the back, she was also walking away from whoever was shooting her. So the momentum made her fall forward where she injured her knees and head.
Oh, so she probably hit her knees and then fell over.
Yeah. And the cause of death was a gunshot wound. The manner of death was homicide, but it took her anywhere from 5 to 15 minutes to bleed out. So this is a list of evidence that was pretty much verbatim from State versus Anderson. There was a hair collected from Olson's body that had the same DNA profile as Anderson's DNA profile. There was DNA analysis of twine that was knotted around Olson's right ankle that could not exclude Olson or Anderson as contributors.
Okay.
Anderson's fingerprint was found on the drawstring of the garbage bag that had been collected from the trash can in the park. The garbage bag contained the blue towel, a blue towel with blood that matched Olson's DNA profile, and Olson's cell phone contained Anderson's thumbprint. So that was on there also. DNA analysis of a blood smear was found at the bottom of the stairs in the Anderson's residence that matched Olson's DNA profile. So he didn't clean up very well either. Mm. There was a Ruger 357 Black Hawk revolver found in Anderson's parents' bedroom. And then there was a fired cartridge in his bedroom underneath a pillow.
Okay, and a fire. He lived with his parents?
Say it again.
He lived with his parents?
Yes.
How old was he?
I'm going to get to that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I am. A firearms expert determined that the revolver fired the bullet found in Catherine's back and the cartridge found in Anderson's room. So they were all related. And the DNA profile from the revolver matched Anderson's DNA profile. Authorities said that Catherine Olson went to the address believing she was going to the home of a married couple with a small child. Instead, she walked into the home of a middle-aged couple and their 19-year-old son. Neither parent was home at the time when Catherine went to the house. So, of course, the 19-year-old son became the person of interest.
Wow.
So the answer is he's a 19-year-old boy.
Wow. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, like, was this his first murder?
Well, as far as I know, it is. But I think that if he hadn't been so stupid, he could possibly have become a serial killer.
Yeah.
I'll explain why in just a few minutes.
Especially if he'd have gotten away with it, then he'd have been like, well, shit, I'm going to do that again.
Right.
Wow.
So, of course, being the person of interest, police wanted to talk with him. So they picked him up at his work, and he worked at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport where he was a jet fueler. He fueled jets. When they picked him up, Savage Police informed Anderson that he was being questioned as a result of a missing person investigation. And he kept saying, why are you picking me up? And they kept saying, we're investigating a missing person and you are a person of interest. They took him to the Savage Police Department for questioning. When they got there, they read him his Miranda rights and he agreed to talk with the officers. You know, they said, do you understand your right to remain silent and all that? And he said, yes, I do. And he agreed to talk. At first, he told police that he had nothing to do with the murder and he denied having phone contact with Olson. But of course, cell phone records indicated that she called him Thursday morning. He also said that he hadn't used Craigslist since January, though the email address in the ad did match his address. He said, well, my mom and three other friends have access to that account. But when confronted with the evidence, he ended up changing his story according to the complaint. He said he was present during Olson's slaying, but the killing was committed by a friend who thought it would be funny to kill an unsuspecting woman. And at that point, he asked for an attorney and he dropped all this information within about 20 minutes of the interview starting.
2007, Law and Order had been out for a long time. I'm sure he had seen him an episode or two of Law and Order. And I mean, to me, I would think, well, I'm not talking. Unless he really thought that he was smarter than the police and that he could convince them that he wasn't guilty. I mean, I don't know.
It's definitely interesting. His defense is interesting, which was kind of why I picked this one.
Okay.
Now, when the press got a hold of the story, of course, it blew up. Headlines like Craigslist killer lures online nanny to her death were splashed across newspapers everywhere. And this is just before there was a guy in Boston who went after Craigslist with a passion. People really? Were horrified. Yes. And he actually he was instrumental in laws about, you know, what can be posted, things like that on, you know,
even not too long ago, there was like an elderly couple that was murdered, like trying to sell a car.
Yeah. Somewhere like in Alabama, wasn't it?
Yeah. It wasn't like far from our area. They were missing for a while.
People were absolutely horrified that Michael John Anderson, a 19-year-old who lived with his parents in Savage, drew a 357 Magnum Black Hawk revolver and shot her in the back. She had been tricked into showing up at this house for a nanny job that she had found on Craigslist. And of course, this was the first murder to be associated with Craigslist, so it garnered international attention. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the world was looking at this case. Craigslist was under fire for their role in Catherine's death, and they quickly posted a warning on the site in the section of education jobs, which included a number of ads seeking nannies and babysitters. Under the heading, they put this statement, warning, for those who don't watch the news, someone who answered a Craigslist ad for a nanny job ended up dead. Be careful out there.
In addition, that's what they put on their website?
I know, that's what I found in the paper. So I don't know, I didn't actually go and research that, but this was from an article that I read. So yeah.
Wow.
In addition, but you know, you think that's kind of callous, but I mean, it could have been an ad from anywhere. It could have been an ad from the newspaper. So, yeah. You know, you can't blame Craigslist for being the vehicle for this, because I mean, think about what was the name of that guy? Who was that guy in Chicago that was a serial killer during the World's Fair, and he lured people with ads?
H.H. Holmes.
Yes. So, I mean, people have been doing this for centuries, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he would rent out rooms to the people.
Right. And yeah. Then they would not show up, usually unsuspecting women, single mm-hmm. women who went there. And he's like, yeah, she was here for a while. And then she ran off with her boyfriend or whatever. All right. So they did put that out there. But one of the founders of Craigslist, actually, I'm thinking the founder himself, Craig Newmark himself, reached out to Catherine's family. I think he sent them a handwritten, he sent them a handwritten letter expressing his sincere condolences. And he wrote, please contact me if you want to talk further. Here's my email. Here's my phone number. I'm available anytime.
Wow.
And yeah, so the dad, Rolf, he's like, I did email him and said, thank you for your condolence. And then I was just sitting there after I hit send and I got an email back from him almost immediately. He said it was like ping, ping. And he said, Craig Newmark said, if there's anything we can do to support your efforts, don't hesitate to call me. And then it was at that point that Rolf decided that, you know, he did want to celebrate his daughter's life. And so he kind of kept Craig Newmark's offer in the back of his mind for a while.
Yeah, Craigslist is still up and running. I'm looking at it.
Yeah, I was going to say, because we used to use Craigslist when we were hiring for the pizza shop, because it's mm-hmm. free.
Yeah.
Trying to put an ad in the newspaper is ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. They even have those anymore?
Yeah, they do, but they're expensive. It's like, you know, $150 for the first 20 words or something.
Oh, wow.
And that's just for, you know, certain days.
Yeah.
All right. So the BCA, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, or whatever those letters stood for, analyzed the computers that were at the Anderson residence. And they found that Anderson had made 67 postings on Craigslist from November 2006 to October 2007. Those postings ranged from requests for female models and actresses, nude photos, a sexual encounter, babysitters, and car parts. On October 22nd, 2007, Anderson posted an ad requesting a babysitter for a 5-year-old girl. That's the one that Olson responded to. When she responded to the ad, he replied posing as Amy and stated that she, Amy, needs someone to babysit her daughter. And after several emails making arrangements, Anderson, who was posing as Amy, arranged to have Olson come to the Anderson residence on October 25th. Olson did call Anderson's cell phone at 8:57, 3 minutes before she was supposed to show up, but no one answered the call. She left a voice message, which police know that he listened to at 8:59 a.m. With this evidence, Anderson was charged with second-degree intentional murder, and his bond was set at $1 million. I never saw that he made bail before being indicted by a grand jury for first-degree premeditated murder and second-degree intentional murder for the shooting death of Catherine Olson. He did plead not guilty by reason of mental illness. So get this, okay? So first he's going to plead not guilty because of mental illness. So his defense team hired a psychologist and a psychiatrist who diagnosed Anderson as having Asperger's. Yeah, I see your face. So do you want to tell our audience a little bit about Asperger's?
Well, it's on the autism spectrum.
Yes.
And I just find that odd that they're trying to say it doesn't make him
a murderer. It doesn't make him mentally ill.
And it doesn't mean that he's like has a mental defect.
Right.
Either.
Okay. So the district court in return ordered a mental examination of Anderson by their own forensic psychologist and a forensic psychiatrist. And those two concluded that he did not have Asperger's and he was not mentally ill or mentally deficient.
Okay. I'm sorry. Why would
he was odd. He was socially awkward.
But how dare them try to say because exactly. he had Asperger's or that he might have had Asperger's
that's a reason to murder someone, right? Yeah.
And that he was insane and to blame. Oh, well, he has Asperger's.
Right.
Like that's bullshit.
Yes,
that like diminishes and is just insulting to anyone who has Asperger's or is on the autism spectrum.
Right.
I mean,
yes. Yeah. And I think the court found that as well. So they denied him that motion to include the expert testimony that the defense got from the psychiatrist and psychologist. Yeah. So later, Anderson ended up withdrawing his mental illness defense and changed his plea to not guilty. And I am going to talk about this because it's kind of important for an appeal, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, the court denied the fact that he had Asperger's. Before trial, his defense team moved to suppress his statements that were made to the police on the ground that he did not waive his Miranda rights or did not fully understand them. But on November 14th, 2008, the district court denied the request. And again, I'm going to go into that later in the appeal. But they're saying, you know, he didn't understand his rights. He's got Asperger's. And they're like, no, it was all recorded. He understood everything.
He's more likely to understand his rights if he has Asperger's.
Right. Exactly. Because it's cut and dried in most cases.
Yeah.
Reporters did get a hold of a couple of friends friends of Michael Anderson's who spoke to them. Tony Dotson and Jake Von Bank were longtime friends and neighbors of Anderson. And Dotson told a reporter that Anderson introduced him to Craigslist about a year before the murder, when the pair went to Minnetonka to get a motor for a go-kart they were building. Now, Dotson told the reporter, "I'm still so confused on why. I don't even know what I'd say to him. I'm just blank." Dotson said that Anderson loved rebuilding engines, shooting paintballs and archery arrows at targets in a nearby park. And they often held Halo parties, you know, hooking up TVs and playing video games. Everybody bring their own TV and their own system. The young men insisted that Anderson was never violent, seldom showed interest in women. Like, he never raised a fist to anybody. And he was always shy around girls.
Mm. And I'm surprised they didn't try to blame Halo on his.
Yeah, they didn't though, or at least not that I found. In September, they said that the last time they saw Anderson was in September 2007, a little more than a month before the murder. And they noticed that he had cut his long time mullet. And this was something that they would tease him about. They teased him about his hair and the turquoise color of his house, which they called aqua fresh teeth. Anderson always chuckled at the playful teasing, according to them. He said that he had to get back into the routine of sleeping. He couldn't hang out with them as much since he had started working nights at the airport. And Dotson said, you know, when I saw him, he seemed fine, just fine. And the whole thing just gets you thinking hard. It's like a bad dream. What is known is that Anderson struggled in school, eventually attending an alternative high school where he eventually dropped out, where he entered the workforce. He had worked in auto parts warehouses until he got a job jet fueling planes at the airport. And he worked nights. He was home alone during the day because his parents worked and he lived with his parents at his. The trial began in 2009. The courtroom was packed. Catherine's parents sat across the aisle from Michael Anderson's parents, but the whole courtroom, which only held like 40 people, they were surrounded by more Olson family members, friends, and parishioners from Roth's church, as well as law enforcement personnel that were involved with the case. On the first day of Anderson's trial, Nancy Olson took the stand to tell the jury about the final time she saw her daughter. She said it was when Catherine was singing in church choir. Prosecutors asked when she saw her daughter next, and she said, "The next time I saw her, she was in a casket at Morris Nielsen Funeral Home, and she was cold and smelled like chemicals."
Oh, God.
Michael Anderson looked down during the opening statements while his attorney, Alan Margulies, detailed his sex life. "Remember," said Margulies, "Michael Anderson was a dumb kid. He had no girlfriend, never dated, never went to a high school dance, and never held a girl's hand." Margulies' plan was to show that his client lured Catherine to a savage home for sex and not, as prosecutors put forth, with the intention to kill. I have a question. Is that any better to try to lure her to your house for sex than it is?
No.
If you lured her to your house for sex and had a gun in your hand, I don't understand that defense at all.
Well, and why did he call him stupid? I mean, he's just a dumb kid. I wouldn't want my lawyer saying that.
I wouldn't either. And I think that they were trying to show that he was, I think they were trying to say that, you know, he's slow. He's not like, you know, intelligence level is not, since I couldn't use the Asperger's or saying, you know.
They just made him sound pathetic.
Yeah.
Which would only make him want to murder somebody.
Right. Exactly. All right. The next day, his mom took the stand, Barbara Anderson, to talk about her son.
I would be like, "Don't say my baby's dumb."
She was soft-spoken and politely detailed on, gave all the details on the day of the murder. She said that Michael had come home from work just like any other day. He didn't say much to his parents before he headed off to his room and they went to work. And she'd say, you know, that was just Michael, that he would never really talk to them unless he had done something fun, like an off-roading trip in his truck or something. The prosecution ended up calling Clint Powell to the stand, and Powell was actually customer service manager for Craigslist, and he was familiar with the technical workings of Craigslist. Powell told the courtroom that Anderson first used Craigslist as a way to find ice fishing gear, truck parts, and collectible plates, and he misspelled words like Star Turk.
Instead of Star Trek?
Yeah. And according to Powell, this pattern changed in October as Anderson started trolling for women. So he was very new to that game of trolling for women because he lured Catherine October 25th.
God, could you imagine having that job to where you had to go through and like categorize and list like all the crazy shit that people are like.
Well, and I think that it might be pretty easy because, you know, they have the, what is the IP address, and they can just look up things that went to the IP address, but yeah.
Well, no, I know, but then someone's got to read it. Then someone's got to testify about it.
Yeah, and... but yeah, absolutely. And, but I don't think they read it on a normal basis.
It's No. Much, I'm just saying, you know, that guy was just like, okay, well now I have to familiarize myself with this freak. And now I will never forget all this shit.
Right. Yeah. So while he was on the stand, Powell read various postings made by Anderson, and one said, looks and size don't mean a lot to me. I'm not little man, but I'm not huge either. I wonder if he's talking about his physique or his penis size.
Yes.
Okay. Another one read, looking for fresh faces for a new video and website, new talent only. Also need 18 plus virgin, willing to be in a video. Okay, yeah, if I'm an 18-year-old virgin, like, I'm going to reply to that? No. Anderson, of course, sat motionless in the courtroom, staring straight ahead the entire time Powell was testifying. His own defense attorney stated, I don't think he made eye contact with a single person the entire trial. He was the quietest defendant I've ever had. So he never said anything on his own behalf, even when his attorney's calling him stupid and whatnot. The defense had tried to make the shooting look like an accident. At trial, they said that Anderson was holding his father's gun when the gun fired by accident, either because he tripped over a box or because his dog nudged his arm, thus causing Olson's death. So he didn't shoot her intentionally. He just happened to be holding the gun that accidentally shot off when he got a little clumsy.
Shouldn't have accidentally had it in his hand.
Right? The state introduced testimony regarding its investigation and Anderson's statement to police. Anderson attempted to prove through other witnesses that he was clumsy, there was some clutter in the house, and that the gun may have discharged accidentally as Olson was running away. Anderson did not testify at all on his own behalf, but I do want to say that being clumsy is one symptom of Asperger's. So people diagnosed with Asperger's are generally a little bit clumsy as they're in puberty. And I don't know when they're adults. I don't know about that, but
yeah, I've never heard that.
On day 5 of the trial, the prosecution called Anderson's former cellmate, Gregory Wiken to the stand. So the cellmate testified that Anderson had bragged about being known as the Craigslist killer. Like, he's bragging in jail. Yeah, I'm the Craigslist killer. The state ended up calling another inmate to the stand, and that particular inmate was an MMA fighter or some sort of like professional fighter. Oh. And I guess Anderson admitted committing the murder to this fighter, and he said, I just wanted to know what it felt like to kill someone. This fighter also testified that Anderson bragged about being more famous than the other inmate because of the high profile term that the media used to describe Olson's murder, you know, nanny, online nanny lured by Craigslist killer. So he was
right.
He was pretty proud of that moniker. Yeah. All right. Anderson also, he testified that Anderson also told him that he was not pleading insanity because, quote, then I would have to pretend that I'm sorry, end quote.
Damn.
The last witness to take the stand was Laura Kvasnicka, who was the detective in charge of the investigation. In her testimony, she detailed Anderson's online life, including his multiple attempts to lure women to his home. According to her, Anderson looked for no strings attached hookups, posting one such advertisement just hours before he killed Catherine. So the trial is over. They do their closing arguments and the judge gives the jury instructions. Now, Anderson's attorney wanted the jury to have his definition of premeditation, because remember, he's first degree murder with premeditation or second degree murder. I can't remember the terminology, but the judge denied him that. You know, we're going to give the jury the legal definition of premeditation, not what you wanted. And I'm going to get to that later during the appeal. The jury only took 5 hours to return its verdict. The Olson family held one another as a 12-member jury announced the news. Michael Anderson was guilty of first and second degree murder, as well as second degree manslaughter. I don't understand how he can be guilty of all of those things, but he was found guilty of all those things. The next morning, the judge, Mary Thiessen, addressed the Olson family with watering eyes. She told them that Catherine's life had touched the entire courtroom. When she turned to Michael, her sympathy turned to rage. She said, "You're a callous, cruel, and unjust human being." And then she sentenced him to a mandatory term of life in prison without parole.
Good for her.
Okay, so I want to just go back to the dad for a minute. And he was sitting in his church office with Catherine deeply on his mind. And then he decided that he knew what to do for Catherine. He wanted to honor her memory through a memorial concert in her name. And he remembered the letter from Craig and decided to contact him. So throughout the ordeal, the family members would walk around their neighborhood talking and thinking, and they came up with this idea for this memorial concert. They contacted Newmark and the company and got an immediate response. They worked with Jim Buckmaster, the CEO of Craigslist, and basically Craigslist took care of the cost of everything.
Wow, that's awesome.
Uh-huh. This actually, Catherine's older, so she had an older sister and a younger brother. And, you know, like, I don't know, it just devastated the whole family. So I didn't go into, like, you know how I can get all sappy with it. All right, so of course, Anderson appeals right away. Now, can you guess what his appeals were?
They didn't let him claim insanity.
Okay.
I don't know, he didn't understand his rights when he was, yada, yada, yada.
Yep, okay. So he actually had 4 different things that he brought up on appeal. First, he argued that 1, he did not waive his Miranda rights so a statement to the police should have been suppressed. 2, the district court abused its discretion and denied him a fair trial when it denied his request to present expert testimony on Asperger's and its effect on him. Thirdly, the court abused its discretion by denying Anderson's proposed jury instructions. And 4, the evidence was insufficient to support a conviction for first degree premeditated murder.
I think that if you're putting something online, soliciting a babysitter for a 5-year-old, a non-existent 5-year-old, that's pretty premeditated.
That's pretty premeditated, right? And you're holding a gun and shoot somebody in the back as they walk away. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. On October 14th, 2010, the higher court upheld the findings of the lower court and denied Anderson's appeal. For his first argument that he did not waive his Miranda rights, the court found that Anderson did understand his rights to remain silent and his rights to an attorney. Anderson only talked with police about 24 minutes before he asked for an attorney, which proved immediately to them that he understood that he did not have to answer their questions.
Thank you.
For their second argument, Anderson was denied a fair trial when the court refused to allow expert testimony regarding his Asperger's diagnosis and its effects on him, the court agreed with the lower court for 2 reasons. First, Anderson was not diagnosed with Asperger's until after he was arrested. He was diagnosed with Asperger's by defense experts, while prosecution experts did not give him that diagnosis. Secondly, he was using that to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. So
it doesn't make him insane.
It doesn't make him insane. And that's why that could not be used in that type of trial. His third argument, that his civil rights were denied to him because the judge failed to adequately instruct the jury on the meaning of premeditation, was denied. Anderson,
who doesn't know what that means?
Well, okay, let me just read it to you. Okay? Anderson argued that the district court abused its discretion by refusing to give his proposed jury instruction, by failing to explain the meaning of premeditation in a jury instruction given in response to a question, because the jury had come up with a question, okay, about the language of premeditation. And the district court did not answer it. The district court said, go back and reread it. And Anderson argues that the state was required to prove that the gunshot was not accidental and that Anderson actually had intent when he shot her, like it was premeditated. And he argues that the jury instructions, that was necessary to argue his theory of the case. So this is what he wanted the jury to hear. The defendant is not guilty of the crimes of first degree murder or second degree murder if the gun held by the defendant accidentally discharged, or if the defendant shot the gun with a purpose other than intent to kill.
Wow.
The burden of proof on this issue is on the state. The state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the gun held by the defendant, one, did not accidentally discharge, and two, that the gun was shot with the intent to kill, for the defendant to be guilty of either first degree murder or second degree murder. If the state does not so prove, the defendant is not guilty of those charges.
Okay, so what if he was planning to murder her, he just wasn't going to shoot her, and then emotions took over and he shot her instead?
That's what
he's still premeditated murder.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter the method of the murder.
Right. The district court instructed the jury on first degree murder, first degree premeditated murder, and two lesser offenses, second degree intentional murder and manslaughter, and the second degree culpable negligence. And this is all gobbledygook lawyery speak. But basically, the court explained that the state has the burden of showing beyond a reasonable doubt that Anderson acted with intent and premeditation in order for there to be first degree premeditated murder. And he's trying to like argue that there has to be time, you know, the word considered. Okay, so there's a word that says Anderson next argues that the word considered and the jury instruction on premeditation was confusing to the jury and misleading in determining whether premeditated murder occurred, because considered implies that an actual decision did not have to take place and that premeditation could occur prior to intent, which is all, I don't understand any of it, whatever. Yeah. Basically, the court in their findings stated that a district court has discretion to decide whether additional instructions are given to a jury. And at this point, they did nothing wrong. So the court's instruction to the jury, which included the word considered, are fine. So there's like, you know, that's an ignorant basis for appeal, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Lastly, Anderson argued that the district court abused its discretion by adding an additional sentence to the instruction on premeditation. And this is the one where it says premeditation means that the defendant considered, planned, prepared for, or determined to commit the act before the defendant committed it. It is not necessary that premeditation exists for any specific length of time. So I guess what defense is trying to say is this was an accident, wasn't premeditated. It was not an intentional act to kill. All right. I don't know. I don't get it. Why would they ever argue?
She's going to lure her to her to the house and, you know, rape her.
And then let her go?
Yeah, right.
All right. Lastly, the court looked at Anderson's argument that the evidence was not sufficient to establish premeditation, and they found that ludicrous. Of course, just like we do. And
yes.
In the findings, the state court wrote three categories are relevant in determining premeditation: planning activity, motive, and the nature of the killing. And then after examining the facts of the case, they described each of those in their briefing. So the first category for premeditation, which is planning activity, was obvious. He planned out the scenario by posting a Craigslist ad on October 27th, 2007, looking for a babysitter for a non-existent 5-year-old girl. I mean,
exactly.
He should have been an attorney. When Catherine Olson responded to the ad, Anderson poses Amy in response. And after a series of emails with Olson, arranged for her to come to his house on the day of the murder, when he knew no one else would be home.
Mm-hmm.
Anderson knew the exact time that she would arrive due to her voicemail. He retrieved his father's unloaded gun from his parents' bedroom, and at some point, he loaded the gun.
Yep.
The gun was a single-action revolver, which required the hammer to be cocked manually and the trigger to be pulled before it could fire.
Didn't go off by accident.
Nope. Anderson had previously completed a training course in gun safety. There was no evidence that she, Olson, got any further than the stairway in the house. A significant amount of her blood was found in front of the stairs and on the first several stairs. As to motive, an inmate testified that when he asked Anderson why he did it, Anderson responded that he wanted to know what it felt like to kill someone or to watch someone die. Anderson told another inmate that he would be more famous than the other inmate was. There was no evidence, however, of an actual or attempted sexual assault. The nature of the murder was a single gunshot near the center of Olson's back. Olson did not die instantaneously, but likely lived for another 5 to 15 minutes, and Anderson did not administer any aid or contact anyone for help. In addition, he attempted to clean up the blood with a towel, broke her cell phone and tried to dispose of evidence, including her purse, in a park some distance from the house. He also attempted to delete the October 22nd online service ad to which she had originally responded by email. Anderson argued that the elaborate email scheme and posing as Amy and requesting a babysitter was to lure Olson to the house for some sort of sexual contact. The circumstances proved do not support a reasonable inference that he lured her there for sexual contact or encounter. Whatever the fuck, who cares why he lured her there? He did. I don't understand the sexual. I mean, maybe it's a lesser crime for sexual. I don't know. That makes it more horrifying to me.
Yeah.
Anyway, the court said rather the circumstances proved were that Anderson lured Olson to his house at a time when no one would be home, that he retrieved a revolver from his parents' bedroom, manually loaded and cocked the hammer, and that upon her arrival at the house, he shot her in the back. None of the circumstances proved suggested an accident or an actual or failed attempt to sexually assault. Thus, the circumstances proved are consistent with guilt and inconsistent with any rational hypothesis except that of guilt. Accordingly, there was sufficient evidence to convict him of first-degree premeditated murder. So the higher court affirmed his conviction.
So I have a question. Does he not say, like, what happened? Like, did she get there and he hit on her? And then she was like, no, I'm not. I don't want any part of this. So I'm going to leave. No. And then he shot her there.
It's very interesting because most of the facts that I found and the evidence came from State versus Anderson. But I did find some articles that said that she actually made it to his bedroom. Like, he's like, come up here. This is where you're going to be, in like the nursery or nanny room or whatever.
And so where was she shot? Like in the yard and the house?
She was shot at the foot of the stairs. So it was a two-story home.
Okay.
So I'm thinking that if she did go upstairs, she was coming back down trying to leave. And so she was shot at the foot of his stairs.
And that's probably like why she was injured too. She might have fallen down the stairs.
Yes, definitely. So the court said there was no evidence that she had been upstairs, but that doesn't mean that she didn't walk up there and then was trying to walk back down.
Right.
That's one of the scenarios that I found, okay. But you know, that's speculation and I can't say.
Right.
Now, as I want to just go back to the memorial concert that they had for her on May 3rd, 2008, 700 of her closest friends and family gathered for this concert at a church to celebrate Catherine Olson.
Wow.
Five members of the Olson family walked onto the stage to, you know, huge applause. And behind them was a tall man. And it turned out to be Craig Newmark, who was a founder of Craigslist. He was introduced to the audience by Catherine's sister, Sarah. And he told the audience, I am really, really humbled and really honored to have been invited here today to speak at this tribute to Catherine, extended by the whole Olson family. I was personally sickened and horrified when I heard about this tragedy. I started Craigslist around 14 years ago as a way to give back to the community. Despite the billions of times well-meaning people have helped each other through Craigslist, it's been devastating to see that it can be used by bad people to take cruel advantage of others and bring a senseless end to a beautiful young life.
Yeah. Can you imagine, like, you create this platform to make life easier and free and, you know,
right.
And people take advantage and, you know, just
right.
Use it to do harm. That's terrible.
Now, this was when he spoke at this was right around the time of Philip Markoff, the Boston Craigslist killer. So he did bring that up. But when he agreed to do the memorial concert, it was before the Philip Markoff. So it just so happened that the other Craigslist killer was going on right around the time that they were having her memorial concert.
Oh, wow.
Months later. And he says, the most recent crime in Boston has been a grim reminder of that.
Mm.
He says, I'm saddened that we met under these circumstances, but I am truly inspired by the Olson family and I extend my love and friendship to them. And I applaud everyone's efforts to let Catherine's light continue. So, I mean, there is still like a Catherine Olson Facebook page out there. I mean, there people have just incredible stories about this woman. She was a beautiful woman whose light still shines, even though she was extinguished by the dark curiosity of a very odd, strange young
man. Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah. So that's it for this week.
Well, thank you very much. It's really sad.
It is. It's horrifying, actually.
And it's scary.
It is.
I mean, we think about it more now, but then we didn't, you know, until something like this happens, you don't really think of the things that could go wrong.
Well, and her parents said that she did not have a care in the world. Like, she didn't fear anything or anyone, you know. She would have
saw the good in people.
Yeah, she saw the good in people, definitely.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to this week's murder. We appreciate sharing our passion with you, and we thank you for your support. If you'd like to support us even further, please consider subscribing to our podcast, giving us a 5-star rating with a comment, please. Your subscription and ratings are essential to our success. You can do this on your favorite platform. For more information and links to our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages, please visit our website at itwasn'tmetruecrime.com.
We are so grateful to spend our time together to share murderous stories. Thank you so much for your support. Please recommend It Wasn't Me to your true crime loving friends and family. Also, thank you to our Patreon supporters. You are the extra. You too can become one of our beloved patrons by signing up at patreon.com/itwasn'tmepod. Thanks again, guys. And remember,
it wasn't me.